As part of our series on governance, we have felt all along that ethics should be one of the central concerns and points of focus, and particularly ethics as it relates to administration and the conduct of public affairs. There's a good deal of writing by people who approach this kind of a subject from a psychological and behavioral standpoint, but much less by political theorists. There's one person at Indiana and one or two others, but William Richardson at Georgia State University has had a long time interest in this and in the subject of literature and politics, particularly concentrating on Mark Twain, Hawthorne, and Melville. He did a fascinating book on Melville. Professor Richardson was born in New York, received his bachelor's, master's, and PhD degree from the State University of New York in Buffalo. He has taught across subfields in political science or government, mainly in political philosophy and in American government. And in the process, emerged as a major theorist of democratic theories and ethics. His writings attest to this interest. They include Self-Interest Properly Understood, The American Character and Public Administration, Administrative Ethics and Founding Thought, Constitutional Corrections, Honor and Education, Thomas Jefferson and Race, The Declaration and Notes on the State of Virginia, and then a major work on Melville. He's received honors and awards from various groups, including the American Political Science Association Marshall Dimmock Award, a National Endowment for the Humanities Summer Seminar Award, an Earhart Foundation Fellowship. He's working on a major treatise on public administration and the foundations of the American regime with a collaborator. Anybody who can work successfully as he has over a long period of time with a colleague at his own institution must know something about ethics and milk of human kindness. So we're delighted to have this opportunity to join with him in a discussion of democracy, ethics, and administration. And following his opening presentation, I hope we can have some discussions.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson, for those kind words. I'm mindful of the appropriateness of speaking in this locale about public administration, democracy, and ethics, not least because of the work of Thomas Jefferson, who wrote so lucidly on the subject of how to educate gentlemen administrators, but also because of the fact that in 1953, Arlington County, Virginia, had a citizens' commission which propounded the first code of ethics for public administration. This code of ethics was adopted by a number of scholars and published in a series of journals, and proved to be the progenitor of most of the codes of public administration which have appeared throughout the United States. Now, the recent midterm elections, while admittedly flawed in their result, nevertheless illustrate a fundamental democratic principle for us, namely that the citizens have the opportunity, at least, to correct what they see to be as political or ethical abuses of power. In the United States, there are approximately 491,000 elected officials scattered throughout some 79,000 political jurisdictions. These elected rulers essentially hold their tenure at the pleasure of the electorate. Unfortunately, this is most emphatically not the case with the 16 million unelected public administrators who are spread out through these same jurisdictions in the United States. These officials, who outnumber the elected representatives by a ratio of more than 34-1, openly violate several principles of the democratic regime. Among these are the Aristotelian principle of rotation in office. For all intents and purposes, they hold their positions for life. Perhaps more seriously is the fact that their source of power, the foundation by which they exercise the powers of their office, is open to serious question. One might summarize these and other objections about public administration as follows. Their claim to rule is suspect in the American regime. Now, historically, there are several accepted ways of substantiating one's claim to rule. American elected officials utilize what has come to be the most commonly accepted source in the Western Hemisphere, namely majority rule. That is not the only source of the claims to rule, however, even in the United States. For example, there's natural superiority. While not commonly accepted as a source of political, economic, or social claim to rule in the United States, it is the manner by which we conduct such activities as sports. There are probably no individuals in this room who seriously harbor the expectation that they can compete professionally in football, basketball, or tennis. Heredity is another source of a claim to rule. Saudi Arabia is seriously in the news of late. Public administration in Saudi Arabia is staffed by several dozen or more of the 3,000 plus princes of the Saudi Arabian royal family. Their claim to rule is neither expertise nor majority rule, but rather bloodline, pure and simple. Merit is the last claim to rule that one can appreciably discuss today. And merit, as it relates to public administration, largely derives from the late 19th century, the civil service reform movement, which overthrew the most democratic method of conducting public administration, which was patronage. The merit principle, which is embodied in some states visibly, such as in Georgia, which calls its system merit system, so there's no confusion in the eyes of the citizens, whether conducted under the guise of professionalism, merit, or expertise, this last category is the single most important claim to rule that is offered by public administration. Unfortunately, it is not the claim to rule which is easily or well accepted by the American people. Now, quite aware of the tenuousness of their claim to rule, public administrators, thoughtful political leaders, political commentators, and scholars of the discipline have made various attempts to bolster the situation with public administration. One of the earliest was made by an individual well known to UVA, Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson's intent was to take a carefully selected group of what he called natural aristocrats and subject them to a carefully selected curriculum designed to produce gentlemen administrators. The variants of Jefferson's approach have been adopted by individuals as diverse as Woodrow Wilson and Herbert Storing. A less difficult but more tenacious attempt at establishing a claim to rule involved a contention that administration was really a science, and as such, removed from the passions and interests which are at the core of democratic politics. In other words, administrators could claim to be removed from ruling and the restraints that are placed on other rulers in the American regime precisely because they were politically and ideologically neutral. Such an argument would have surprised the founders, who would not have expected most administrators to be appreciably different from the citizens from whose ranks they were chosen. It also didn't persuade many individuals of leaving a nodding acquaintance with human nature. Beginning in the 1940s, the subterfuge was even abandoned by most scholars of public administration, primarily on the grounds that the discretion, which is at the core of what is just, moral, and practical about public administration, is so blatantly an exercise of political power. This leads us to the center of the contemporary debate over public administration and ethics. How can we assure that this political power known as discretion is used in a morally and ethically appropriate manner. Now, my examination of many of the Founding Fathers' writings has culminated in basically three strands of thought that apply to this matter of the control of public administration. And I've called them constitutional correctives, a concern with honor or reputation, and education. And I'll briefly discuss each of them in turn. Now, the constitutional framework advocated by the founders accepted the premise that the American character would be self-interested to the point that the private sphere would normally be more important than the general welfare as a guide to action. In the founders' eyes, people were in the main ambitious and self-interested, and they should be expected to make the improvement of their own conditions the basis for political choice. Those who govern a free people, therefore, must seek to use and channel the motive of self-interest. The founders were emphatically unwilling to write a constitution based on the assumption that virtuous governors would always be available and in office. Since these governors were to be drawn from the ranks of the governed, the founders argued that they realistically could be expected to resemble their fellow citizens and that they, too, would usually be self-interested. As expressed by Publius in the Federalist Papers, the founding point of view maintained that a constitution applying a composition of federal and national principles to an extended republic was necessary because people were not angels, and, left to their own devices, could not reliably be expected to select virtuous leaders. Publius's forceful criticism of classical republican approaches to public virtue, particularly such approaches as inability to homogenize the opinions, passions, and interests of a naturally diverse citizenry without squelching liberty, is well known. Publius's treatment of the causes of factional politics and the corrective functions of an extended commercial republic still stands as the clearest, most powerful statement of this perspective on the connections between citizen character and the American regime. In this view, the belief that democratic citizens and governors would possess superior virtues simply could not be relied upon as the foundation of the regime. Accordingly, the alternative was to accept as the bedrock of the regime that character trait most commonly in evidence, namely self-interest. Now, the founders recognized that self-interest was, by itself, an inadequate foundation for the regime they contemplated. Restraints were needed. They did not, however, choose to rely on an aristocracy of virtuous governor-administrators to achieve that restraint. Citizens, elected governors, and administrators were to be restrained by constitutional correctives. The founder's system of such correctives requires public administrators who both appreciate and actively support it. John Rohr of VPI, for example, argues that ethical standards derived from regime values should apply to bureaucrats because they are sworn to defend the regime. They take an oath. In this context, he turns to the character-forming role of the U.S. Supreme Court. He points out that Supreme Court procedures and opinions often teach enduring principles, offer insightful interpretations of American values, have direct applicability to administrative actions, and raise questions that are useful for reflection on fundamental values. While accepting that citizens would be driven by passions and interests, the founders also expected something better, for men are driven by a variety of passions, and many of these, love of fame, of glory, of country, are noble. When any such passion becomes a man's ruling passion, he must necessarily live his life in virtuous service to the public. And it was such men whom the Federalists counted on to govern others through their baser passions. Forrest MacDonald, citing George Washington's example, suggests that the Federalists subscribe to the idea that public persons are and should be governed mainly by the law of honor or outward esteem. A desire for the esteem of those of high reputation should be the guiding standard of individuals in public life. Now, with regard to reputation, it has been a long time since civil servants in America have been held in high esteem by the general citizenry. So if the founders were correct in believing that public virtue is closely connected to reputation and approbation, must it necessarily suffer when those who want to be praised, the bureaucrats, and to see themselves as praiseworthy are not reinforced by public approval? In his study of administration, Woodrow Wilson recognized the problem. He stated that administration in the United States must be at all points sensitive to public opinion and earn its praise through hearty allegiance to the policy of the government. Since the American regime rests solidly on the principle of majority rule, Wilson understood that any fundamental solution to the problem of public administration would have to be grounded in that majority's opinion. His solution included a call for civil service reform and professionalism. Now, between 1887, when Wilson wrote, and the present, his call for merit systems and a technically trained civil service has, in large measure, been achieved. However, the anticipated improvement of public opinion never materialized. Charles Goodshill has colorfully described the current climate in the following terms. Bureaucracy is despised and disparaged. It is attacked in the press, popular magazines, and bestsellers. It is denounced by the political right and left. It is assaulted by molders of culture and professors of academia. It is castigated by economists, sociologists, policy analysts, political scientists, organizational theorists, and social psychologists. It is charged with a wide array of crimes, failure to perform, abuse of political power, and repression of employees, clients, and people in general. In short, bureaucracy stands as a splendid hate object. Under these conditions, the founding strategy would appear to stand a better chance of success if the range of those to whom public administration looks for approval were severely narrowed. Along these lines, a favorite approach in the United States has been to attempt to build a foundation for public virtue through professionalization and codes of ethics for public administrators. While the public service is now highly professionalized, by which I mean it is staffed by a wide variety of experts, most students of the field believe the public administration itself has not yet achieved the status of a profession. The desirability of such a profession, of course, has been the subject of lively debate since Wilson's essay. Despite these difficulties, many academics and practitioners have urged that professional standards be adopted and applied uniformly to all administrators. In part, the aim is to provide a reference group of professional peers to guide and evaluate behavior. What remains unresolved is the possibility that substantial differences between public opinion and professional norms could arise, even to the point that what Wilson called an offensive administrative class could emerge. Stephen Bailey and Frederick Mosier are perhaps the best known academic commentators on the tensions between professional standards and democratic norms. Both accept the inevitability of a government dominated by professionals who exert significant influence on public policies. The problem may be that these same individuals see little or no honor in serving democratic norms or constitutional principles. If professional peers are to be the primary points of reference for public administrators, education may be the most effective way of orienting them to these standards. The importance of a proper education for those who would govern the American regime was a central concern of the founders. In addition to expressing their belief that the small republic was itself a school of citizenship, a number of the Anti-Federalists proposed the establishment of schools or seminaries where youth could be educated in the habits of public virtue. Citizens, they argued, should be broadly educated in morality and the useful arts and sciences. Such education would form virtuous citizens who, instead of abusing, would wade up to their knees in blood to defend their governments, according to Jefferson. The Federalists were no less interested in the education of the regime's future leaders. Several among them, including Madison and Washington, proposed the establishment of a national university for this purpose. They hoped to foster the habits of public virtue through a combination of public and private sources of education. At least indirectly, certain aspects of John Locke's commentaries on education are reflected in the Federalists' thinking. Locke, who wrote extensively on the subject of education, stressed the character-forming functions of the family and urged the class of gentlemen to use certain methods to instill public virtues during childhood years. While civil law and religion have roles to play in morality, Locke thought the socially derived standards of public opinion more powerfully affected individual conduct, including one's choice of occupation. Therefore, he stressed the need to educate children in the standards or opinions of the community. This early socialization teaches not only standards, but also the ideas of rewards or penalties associated with actions that uphold or violate them.
In Locke's scheme, a successful education of this sort would control even those who might otherwise casually break religious or civil laws out of self-interest. Now, Thomas Jefferson's influence on public administration thought has recently received considerable attention. His ideas regarding education are particularly significant, in part because they are based on a treatment of self-interest that is somewhat at odds with that of the Federalist and Locke. In his notes on the state of Virginia, Jefferson considers his law establishing an educational system in the state to be one of his most important contributions, primarily because of the need for a public education that would prepare the people to defend their liberty. As a defense against ambitious contenders, the government should provide for the basic education of the people. Contending that people will be happiest whose laws are best and are best administered, and that laws will be wisely formed and honestly administered in proportion as those who form and administer them are themselves wise and honest, Jefferson set forth a plan to discover those fitly formed children whom nature had endowed with genius and virtue. After a selection process which grew progressively more rigorous as the students advanced in their studies, those few students possessing the most superior parts and disposition were to be sent on for 3 years of study. In conclusion, the contemporary interest in ethics for public administrators is really consistent with the founder's view that, left to itself, the citizenry of whom public administrators are a part would act in a self-interested manner. The problem, however, is that the regime requires public administrators who can be reliably expected to act in the public's behalf. The greatest irony of public administration since Wilson's essay may lie in the success of policies and practices designed to avoid the creation of anything resembling an administrative class. In combination with the emphasis on technological expertise or public management, the lack of any identifiable community of public administrators may have seriously eroded the foundations upon which the founders relied to assure that the regime would be served by publicly virtuous administrators capable of being superintended by public opinion.
Certainly raise some critical issues. Who'd like to begin the discussion?
Yes, Dan, Professor Metter.
Yes, I wonder if I could ask you to make a comparative comment in two directions, focusing on the federal government and the federal civil service. Could you comment on a comparative way about the federal civil service compared with the foreign service in this country and compared with the civil service in England? My impression would be, as far as public regard goes, and reputation for merit and even ethics and whatnot, that both the Foreign Service and the English Civil Service would come out ahead of our civil service in the federal government. And I wonder what you thought about that, and why are there differences?
Could you hear Professor Mander's question?
Good. Take the easier portion of that first. The British system. Up until very recently, the British had no schools of public administration. They had no program of public administration. It was primarily an attempt to educate gentlemen through select public schools who would then be sent into various bureaus and agencies where they would learn their craft. It was more a concentration on character and to a lesser extent on what we would call old boy connections. And it worked rather well in a system that had such aristocratic foundations. The portion of your question regarding the Foreign Service officers in the United States has some relationship to the British method. First, the merit portion of the federal, the Foreign Service officer exams, I think are fairly well recognized by the citizenry for the arduous nature of it. Those I have known who've gone through what at the time were the three-part or three-tier system of exams, there could be no doubt at the time that you completed the exam process that you had been subjected to a very stern and exacting taskmaster identifying your particular skills. The harder part of the question, of course, is that
some of the foreign service officer examination has been democratized. One of the chief criticisms against the foreign service selection process had been that it had a tendency to rely on certain schools, oftentimes to the exclusion of schools that had more democratic origins, such as state universities. And over the past 20 or so years, from what I do know of it, there has been at least a concerted public attempt to correct that by active recruiting on state university campuses, et cetera, as an effort to broaden the pool from which Foreign Service officers perhaps were initially selected. I would not classify the Foreign Service merit selection process as one of the major points of concern about public administrators. In fact, what has happened is that most of the ways in which public administrators are now traditionally accepted are very narrow, and the connection with merit is not so clear, particularly with the demise of some of the general federal civil service exams over the past 15 years.
Next question. Henry Thielberg.
In the definition, I'm interested in the definition of public interest. We've always had a certain amount of single issue promotion or power, but increasingly that is becoming a very strong factor, not only in the selection, but I think in the selection of people who are elected, but also in the action of people who are in the bureaucracy. It seemed to me, from an ethical standpoint, it's extremely difficult for a public administrator to ride against or contrary to the point of view of a very aggressive single interest group, even though that may represent only a small portion of the total electorate. Now, how does one handle this, at which I believe is becoming increasingly important?
The definition of public interest has always been a matter of some concern and dispute. One could take sort of Madisonian's view of the compilation of various factional interests. And what we are seeing presently, I think, are, of course, our passionately held self-interests, which is not the case with most of the general citizenry most of the time. In fact, that would violate much of what Madison was about. The concern with the public administrators is, I guess, not so much that they would succumb to passionately held single interest group opinions, although that surely can be a situation, rather that they would follow rather clearly defined self-interested motives in making various decisions. And since, by definition, public administration must have a fair amount of discretion, whether it's the discretion of the clerk at the Social Security office who's examining your papers as you apply for a Social Security number, or the discretion of a relatively high administrator who's making policy in that way. It's the use of this discretion, the attempts to hem it in, now largely by codes of ethics, which are the preferred method, as opposed to dealing with issues of the character of the administrators themselves, which would be a substitute for their reliable exercise of the public's interest without regard to their own influence on it. And that's the approach taken by Herbert Storing and others, and to a lesser extent by Thomas Jefferson.
Could I follow up on Mr. Theobar's question? What about this problem that our late colleague Fritz Moser used to talk so much about, namely the politicization of the bureaucracy down to a much lower level than it previously had been? I suppose it isn't so strange that Governor Martinez would be selected by a Republican administration to be the drug czar, if that's what the person is, since that's a top position, cabinet level. What it wasn't cabinet level, though, what was it with Bennett? But you have a problem there, I imagine, in that it's such a tech complicated problem that you might even say that ought to be something like the problem of selecting the best doctor, since there are several in the room. You don't take a public opinion poll. You try to get information from people who know about the best doctor.
You get a second opinion.
And you trust to the Hippocratic Oath.
Yes. But Mosier's argument was that, for instance, in OMB, Office of Management and Budget, it now had gone down to the top 16 positions, and that it wasn't any different with Carter, that both Reagan and Carter did this. What effect does that have on the public service?
First, I would argue that part of Mosier's argument is in reaction to the then ongoing subterfuge that indeed administration really was a science. You still pick up some of this in the literature of scholars and others who really contend that they're neutral. And again, any candid observer of the scene has to admit that these individuals had political prejudices, and that one could hope and trust that they would keep those political prejudices under some degree of control in making decisions when they use their discretion. The surveys we make of political preferences of administrators, much like we do of journalists and others, tend to show a heavy bias, and that bias tends to be more towards the Democratic than the Republican Party. Terms of their past voting behavior. The issue of what they can do with their discretion, however, again, is going to come back to the education, I think, in terms of the attempts to limit their politicization. We've always had that. I think we just went through a period of 40, 45 years where we denied it, and tried to find another crutch that would support them as a claim to rule, what I'm calling a claim to rule.
I get ads and announcements frequently from groups who say that they would educate people in the right way, either the radical way or the neoconservative way, to train them for the Foreign Service. And there are programs now that have been established because they say that too few people of those points of view, radical or neoconservative, are represented in the Foreign Service.
Ideological affirmative action.
Yeah. So there's a lot of that out there, and maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. Is that public virtue? Or?
Wilson, in particular, would argue that he wanted subservience to the government policies, and that your ideological predilections were not that important as long as you were willing to exercise your discretion and subservience to whatever the reigning government wanted you to do. It only becomes a problem when you use your ideology or your morality to resist and retard, generally under cover of darkness, the policies of the government that you are taking oath to serve.
Dr. Chris Bell, did you?
Could you talk a little bit about Pat? As I remember, Robert Kennedy's last words was interview with Walter Cronkite was that it ought to be free time and that television stations should not be allowed to charge for putting on candidates for closure. It seems to me that the real problem we got in this country, will Congress ever have guts enough to do away with the amount of money that's spent on elections? Senator Spahn, who's talked to us here many times, I sat in his office one day during the time he knew he was going to be defeated, and he said the problem was he didn't have any television money. So it seems to me that PAC and television are electing people. And if you take the recent Florida campaign, which is one of the dirtiest I've ever seen, I'm pleased that even with all his money, the present government couldn't win. Do you see any hope to eliminating PAC? I think this was started as a salve to United Mine Workers, wasn't it?
I'm not familiar with the history of that.
Is that right?
I think so. Union groups, sir.
Union groups.
Well, it was to counter. They said unions could do it, so now you should have others.
To counter what the unions.
Yeah.
Do you see any hope of eliminating
Well, the PACs were set up as a way of getting around this connection between self-interest and public interest. That is the perceived notion that the fat cats were going to influence you as a candidate for office by the fact they had given you so much money. And so the original purpose was to limit the amounts of money so that you were getting money from lots of different smaller sources. The intent perhaps was admirable, the result has been awful. Looks at it.
There's no ethics.
Well, everyone is playing the game to the hilt. And so that you as a candidate challenging an incumbent are at some considerable disadvantage, particularly if you have not done something scandalous to get your name before the public before you run for office, that you have to make your name known, and the best way to do that is going to be through television time, and commercial stations are unlikely to donate it to you. I don't see Congress as self-reform.
Professor Fernbach and then Victor Yonke.
I wonder whether there isn't a problem of fine-tuning some of the definitions. For example, the term professionalism is very broad. I think I'm a professional. What I find in my professional field, there is considerable disagreement as to what standards are in certain areas. As far as I know about other professions, there is no uniformity as to what professionalism really means, except that the layman doesn't understand what we do. Secondly, when you come to the term public opinion, obviously it's a terribly diverse public that you're dealing with in this country, and the interest groups are not the only factors, and it is mercurial. It doesn't stay put, and it is generally short range in its outlook, whereas at least occasionally a bureaucrat has to think in a longer range term, even beyond the election of congressmen, and this creates some very tough problems. Finally, would you comment perhaps on the British service in terms of yes, minister?
Could you hear the question? He wants a redefinition, clearer definition of professionalism, public opinion, and the tyranny of public opinion, and then he wants to know what about yes, minister?
I'll take the American question first, professionalism. I think one of the growing dangers with the push towards professionalism as a way of getting respect, a way of having a peer group that you can turn to for support both in conflicts with your agency or department or your political brethren, as well as some of the ways in which professional codes of ethics are being promoted, potentially can be very undemocratic. It depends, obviously, on the profession. But there is a hearty danger out there that some of these professional organizations may not have democratic norms and constitutional principles at the core of their animating being. And depending upon public administrators who do rule, whether they be city managers or city planners or whomever who have a professional group, these individuals can come to be torn. And I am not convinced that that is the most appropriate avenue that we should be promoting at all. It's the avenue we're taking, but I'm not a strong advocate of it. The matter of public opinion, I will take refuge in basically Tocqueville. Most of the public opinion that we survey, we're surveying opinion that may not be passionately held when I ask you your opinion about a given subject. And you may tisk-tisk at the result of a particular political or administrative decision, but you're not outraged. You're not likely to take to the streets. You're not probably even likely to write a check in support of somebody proposing it. Madison's view would be that, say, physicians and lawyers who lobby avidly in the Atlanta State Capitol over restrictions on trial awards, where the rest of the citizenry sits back and watches, that those are pretty evenly matched, passionate, self-interested groups. And whatever the outcome, it's probably not going to do much harm to the rest of the citizenry. Or if it does, it'll be quickly corrected, as an example. The yes minister, I don't think we have any shortage of individuals who are also yes ministers at various high levels in the American bureaucracy either. It is a problem of those where you don't hear what you should hear, but it's not the ethical problem. It perhaps is a problem of information and job protection. We're dealing with the ethical concerns.
Other questions? Ms. Victor.
Professor Robertson, I think that on general study acceptance, the United States diplomatic service is equal to any between the British. So I think where we have a weakness and an inherent problem are these political appointees at ambassadorial levels and below that. And together with that, I participated this week, not here, but in Charlottesville, my career, military and naval personnel, that the biggest handicap to our counterintelligence system is our ambassadors. I think that's an outrageous statement to make. I think if we could have career civil servants not being locked below the levels of political appointees, we might be much more effective. We wouldn't have to apologize to anybody.
I have nothing to disagree with that. That not being my area of expertise either. The situations where we do have professional career foreign service officers who are appointed ambassadors would appear to be the more desirable situation, having demonstrated their expertise and competence and loyalty and all the other important ingredients through long yeoman service, as opposed to the sort of other reasons for which one would be appointed ambassador because of one's political concerns and ideology.
Yes.
Do you think the teaching of ethics in the schools would help starting young instead of waiting till they get to a college age where possibly many influences have already come to play in their socialization and, you know, through television or all sorts of influences we see today? A code for their behavior has already been set.
In general, that would probably be salutary. Unfortunately, a lot of what passes as instruction and education, educational ethics, both at the college level and the professional level, is what we might call situational ethics. What would you do if the lights went out and the cash register was open? And it tends to make the participants glib. It's not intended to necessarily form character or habituate them into right versus wrong action. If you look at the curriculum that is being taught at the college level, which I'm most familiar with, there's not a lot of it that is based upon Aristotelian premises or political theory. It's psychological. It's something where I can get a fat consulting fee to come in and do a three-day seminar to mid-level managers to tell them basically what they already should know they shouldn't be doing on that. And one can walk away feeling relatively good about it.
How about teaching it through the history point of view? Then you have examples that they're learning history and also by example. There is a
growing movement to teach what they're calling exemplars of public administration. Strange word, but while there are no shortage of great political statesmen that we can teach, particularly about in Virginia, such as Jefferson, and say, you know, this is what a political leader should be and do. There is a shortage of public administrators that one could advance and say, well, this is what you should emulate. And when I was recently asked to contribute a chapter to a book on public administration exemplars, I chose the only one I could really have confidence in, Alexander Hamilton, to deal with. And they're basically looking at other unknowns out there, the 20th century unknowns that they're trying to advance as appropriate examples.
You think it's a shortage, or do you think we just don't know enough about it? Do you think if you sat down with Dr. Crispell, he might tell us all about the three administrators he's known in medical education who stand above everybody else, or Professor Metter in the law, but the public and scholars as well never get contact with.
The tendency is perhaps to choose what we're calling our whistleblowers, and reward them, and we're careful about trotting them out, however, because when you look at their long-term record, some of these people are not real savory, nor stable, and we may not want to make them too visible, which is unfortunately been the case with a large number of them. And that, too, is probably the wrong orientation, to look at these individuals who have sacrificed all and gone outside channels to expose what they consider to be great abuses, as opposed to little-known people who may have, under extraordinary conditions, performed admirably and need to be more celebrated.
Dr. Latham?
A new idea that's come to the fore, particularly in this last election, was the limitation of term of office. Yeah. Now, is that going to solve any of the problems at all, or is that going to...
That's undemocratic. You know, I'm opposed to your congressman continuing in office, but generally my congressman is returned to office because he served my district well.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the nation, that has generally been the view, with few exceptions. You like your congressman. It's the next district that you don't like, and you'd like to see new blood. And for us to pass a term limitation... for those reasons, because we have a host of individuals in office who we just can't pry out, there are probably better ways of doing so. One of the ways that they have devised, of course, is that, was it 92? After 92, you no longer can keep your accumulated campaign funds. So self-interest may help to remove some of them from office with some alacrity.
But it's not likely to pass in Congress.
Congress isn't going to pass it. It may come out in form of initiatives from the states, but it's not going to come out of Congress.
Mrs. Madison?
In public administration, you find that the democratic way is to bring these people up sort of through the ranks, and that's how our civil service got so strong. And now the great problem is that they're not educated before they get the job. They're educated, they try to educate them afterwards, and then you can't get rid of them. I mean, there's a difference to get rid of someone in civil service.
Yeah, I think that's a problem that's endemic to the citizenry as a whole and not just limited to those who are public administration aspirants. As someone who teaches in a state university, whether they're going into business or public administration, there are problems with the level of their preparation.
Wouldn't it be better to make those requirements before they get into there rather than after they get into there?
Leave, and that's their entree, their union card. That's not truly the case.
Bill Wemple and then Colonel Pete.
It seems to me very dangerous to, first place, you can't do anything about the elected and politically appointed people. That's governed by politics, and unless we go to some kind of a authoritarian government, that's the way it's going to be. Just take your chances. On the civil service, non-political, it seems to be very dangerous to think that we can sit here or other people there or someplace and map out what should they be taught, what should they learn. The question is, who is going to decide that? And you'll have as many views on who's going to decide it as you, before you even get to what it is. So it seems to me we probably muddle along with some requirements for certain formal schooling. And also that it's not a good idea to have been convicted of fraud. And beyond that, it's taking tests, and maybe it's also partly who you know, but essentially, I don't think we can go to a pure merit system in the sense of a merit for the particular position, because we don't can't agree on who's going to be the decider.
Well, the merit system is, the merit question is somewhat distinct from the ethical question. The merit question has to do largely with your ability to do the job, the accumulated knowledge that you have brought with you. The ethic question, intentionally or otherwise, addresses the question of character. And it's not a great books question. It's from the perspective of Locke and Madison and Jefferson as well. They weren't all that deeply concerned about the moral works that you were exposed to. Jefferson didn't want you to read too heavily in the Bible and other things. But aside from that, they were using private and familial methods of assuring that your character was sound. In some cases, some religious components to it. Jefferson, when he sent you off for the 3 years of education, basically was sending you off to study science. Your character was already formed. He wasn't sending you off to take 3-day seminars in ethics. He figured that you now knew about honesty and trustworthiness and loyalty, and I couldn't teach you those anyway. You're already coming with those. And he was using the other ways in which he culled you out to find out whether you were a good character. Once I find out that you have a record, I've already proven that your character is suspect, and I can make my selection process a little easier. But that's too late. You already demonstrated it. We're talking about before you have the temptation. We don't yet know how you're going to act.
Colonel P.
Nowhere in our tradition is one of falling upon one's sword when he is disclosed as having done something terribly dishonorable, or even has simply had a disagreement with his boss to the extent that he simply feels that he cannot remain with an administration that has made a decision of such a critical nature. He just, I can't think of more than two or three in my whole lifetime. And I can think of a couple even just in the British Parliament. Mm-hmm. One who is walking down to announce the new taxes, said an aside, and he resigned, realizing that he had violated his trust. And another one who was thrown out of Parliament for lying, the Profumo case. And he took a trampoline and left. Give us, I don't know where that tradition is going to be inculcated or where it's going to come from, but I certainly urge it.
It's a question that is looked at with askance in treatments of ethics, namely the shut up or walk response. And the general explanation given is one of self-interest. These folks can't afford to walk. They've got 12 years, 15 years invested in a government career, and they can't afford, because of their disagreement with a particular administrator or political leader, that they feel very strongly about, to just quit on principle. In other words, we've already drawn a wall around this. And no, we can't do that. And the reason advanced is generally one of wealth. I cannot afford, at that career, to lose the income. I am an individual of modest means, and the principle, therefore, is going to have to defer to the need for sustenance. And that's not a real compelling reason. It depends on how strongly you feel about the issue. And that's why they're setting up anonymous ways in which you can keep your job and still squeal about what's going on. You set up 1-800 numbers to please tell us about fraud in your department, but you can't come forward. That's not ethics.
I was thinking of a military example of a man who was chief of the Army General Staff during the war in Vietnam, who two or three times on the point of going up and seeing the man of the same name, President Johnson, and resigning. And then he didn't. And he spent his last years bemoaning his lack of courage to do this. And his justification was that he knew all this, and anybody who came in had a long, long time picking up all these threads of power and understanding. That's the way you justify it to yourself, but you shouldn't be able to.
Yes.
To
my question relates to the greatest good for the greatest number. Is that so confused and imponderable and unresolvable that self-interest always takes over? I'm going back to this lady's premise here. Why isn't the greatest good for the greatest number taught at the mother's knee, and so that it's an indoctrination in everybody's thinking as they grow? And therefore, self-interest would be a second rather than a primary goal.
I think the saving grace of the American regime, which is indeed based on self-interest, which is not a noble sentiment, is the fact that we have had such a large number of people who will serve out of nobler impulses and for nobler reasons, and will be willing and able and quite content to put aside their personal self-interest. The point of view of the founders, which is too often neglected, is that we can't rely on those individuals being present, particularly when we most need them. It's wonderful if we do. It's wonderful if they come from a familiar or educational situation which stresses the nobility of self-sacrifice and the concern for others, what we might call the Mother Teresa School of Public Administration. It's not present out there as something that is going to produce great numbers of these individuals. They do appear at times when they are hopefully most needed. But we have to have in place structures and devices and other restraints that will resist those who are raised in a less noble environment and are more likely to pursue self-interest if presented the chance.
Henry Seale?
I'm a little concerned that people feel that there has to be an education in ethics. My trade, it was not very difficult to determine what is ethical and what is not. I think in
investments.
Let's take fiduciary responsibility. I think anybody who has fiduciary responsibility has a pretty good idea of what is right and what is wrong. You get into a problem of the end justifying the means in some areas, but I think that that is fairly well understood. Where you're crossing the border, seems to me not that there isn't an understanding of what is ethical. Basically, it's a question of implementing it and what are the advantages and the disadvantages of crossing the line.
If you read some of these codes of ethics, they're frightening. And they're frightening because they leave one with the impression that some individuals out there may be wanting in the most basic character traits. One of the professional associations for public administrators even has a Dear Ethics hotline, so that if you are an administrator and you're confused about whether you should accept a free hotel room for yourself as a member of an agency that is going to grant a contract, you can call and be reassured whether indeed that's the norm.
Well, that's
that's nonsense.
Well, also, it's what it is only, that you're trying to get an excuse so you can do it.
Sure, you're looking for peer support. Oh, yes, this was done in Texas last year. You're free to do it. The codes of ethics, I think, are not a salutary move for that. They bespeak a lack of character, a potential lack of character, which, as you say, you take for granted. You know what is yours and what is someone else's, and the fundamental honesty or trustworthiness or loyalty or whatever trait you want to take, you assume that goes with the territory. The assumption is not made with some of these codes of ethics, which are terribly explicit on the kinds of conduct which they're advising you not to engage in, which you thought any normal reasoning human being would understand.
It's a little like the tax code, where if there's a very complicated pattern of what is law, it's a very good thing for a smart tax lawyer, because then he can use that as the basis around which he works. Whereas if it's a loose definition, he has a much greater problem.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw the announcement on the relationship of the demand for Social Security numbers for individuals over five and the drop in dependents reported to the IRS. The drop has been something in the order of 7 million from self-interested citizens who were claiming more than their due. The tax code tended to restrain that externally.
Well, we've followed our usual hour rule, and we've certainly benefited from it, and we want to thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.